in the essay Close, Joanne Beard writes, "We have to find new and surprising ways to convey our insights. That means we have to have insights, which means we have to think. And that means we have to work to create art out of life, to bring something new to each sentence, a surprise for the reader." Beard is describing the challenge facing writers, but also happens to be listing many of the qualities which, as a reader, I have discovered in her essays. For a Joanne Beard essay is surprising, insightful, thoughtful, contains something new in each and every sentence. A Joanne Beard essay creates art out of life. Recently published in the UK as The Collected Works of Joanne Beard, the two books, 1999's The Boys of My Youth and 2021's Festival Days, combine the stylistic flair and pace of fiction with the ineffable weight of the factual, creating in the reader a rare and profound sense of empathy mediated through the imaginative act. Joanne Beard is quite unlike any other writer I've read, and I'm delighted to say she joins me on the podcast today. Joanne, welcome to the Shakespeare and Company podcast.
Thank you.
I always like interviewing writers whose work I have difficulty pinning down, or work I have difficulty describing. And I gave a bit of a go at it in the introduction there, which I think if listeners haven't read your work, when they pick it up, I could imagine they might think they're reading a collection of short stories to begin with. And then as they make their way into each piece, suddenly I think the essayistic nature of them takes over. But to my mind, they're neither quite one thing or the other. Do you have a way that you talk about your work when people ask you what it is you write?
Well, I have a very hard time with that question, the same way you're having a hard time with that question.
That's a relief to know.
Thank you. And in fact, in the book, Festival Days, which is collected in the Collected Works, there are a couple of long short stories that began in my mind as essays, but then sort of morphed through the writing of them into something that I couldn't have predicted. Mm. And it goes back kind of to what you said right at the beginning, which is that that there are surprises embedded into certain essays and stories that you might not have predicted when you start reading them. Mm-hmm. And I think that that is the same process that I experience as a writer, where I begin with an idea or a fragment of an idea or an image, and I just embark. Mm-hmm. And I wait to see where that takes me. And always, always, 100% of the time, where it takes me is someplace I couldn't have predicted, and which, you know, is surprising in terms of maybe what I discover in the writing, which is probably different than what a reader would discover in the reading of it. But what matters the most, I think, is that sense of surprise, of not knowing where you're going to go when you embark on the journey.
Do you have a feeling, when the way we categorize writing, either as fiction or nonfiction stories or essays, is in some way restrictive? Do you find it unhelpful? Would it be more interesting for you if we just talked about writing or prose?
Well, it's funny, for me, there's a division between who I am as a reader and who I am as a writer. Mm-hmm. As a writer, I'm not interested in those divisions at all. I feel that it's my job to just write the story. And if the story moves into a realm that feels more fiction than nonfiction, then I call it fiction. And if it stays in the realm that I think is more nonfiction, then that's what I call it. But I will confess that when I'm reading, I do want to know. Mm-hmm. I do want a sense before I begin whether this is something that really happened or not.
It's funny, isn't it? There is a sort of almost like a pre-contract that the reader feels they enter into. And I find this at the bookstore, that it's very important for readers to know if something actually happened, whatever that means.
I agree with you. And even this morning, sitting at my breakfast table reading the New York Times, there was a front page story that I started reading in the Times, which is supposed to be as factual as we can get it. And we know everything is subjective, but as factual as we can get it. And halfway through this, you know, news, supposed news piece, I just said to my husband, no, this is not newspaper reporting. Mm. This is, you know, this is somewhere between fiction and nonfiction. And it's scary when you see that in the New York Times. Mm-hmm. And I have a lot of sympathy for writers because, you know, we're trying to write the best story we can. But if you're writing journalism, you really have to be as faithful as you can mm-hmm. to what we call the factual truth.
At a moment, you write that your first love was poetry. And then you go on to say your second love was fiction and your third and lasting love was the essay. But do you think that first love of poetry is what informs that fragment approach you were talking about a moment ago, that you begin with an image and the story or the essay builds from there?
I think that that's exactly true, that that's where that began, and that feeling of trying to write poetry, when I just sort of randomly took a poetry class, and suddenly I thought, oh my God, I love this. I love just sitting in a chair with a pen, mm-hmm. thinking of pictures in my head and trying to apply language to them that would illustrate them in a way like a painting on a page. Mm-hmm. And I turned out not to be very good at poetry, really not very good at poetry, but that feeling of loving to apply language to image in the way that you apply paint to an image, it's my favorite thing in the world.
And just to set that aside, another thing you write, I think in the same piece, is you say that a good essay, and indeed for that matter, a good short story, a good memoir, novel, is about ideas. That's how it elevates itself beyond and above its nominal subject. Now, having read your work, I could see how these two concepts sit together, the kind of the poetic, but also being ideas-based. But is, in a sense, even though the good essay to your mind is about ideas, is it the ideas that sort of rise up through the writing rather than through an idea that you have before you sit down to write?
Yes, and that's a perceptive reading of my work. Because I don't begin with an idea, I begin with an image. But as a teacher of nonfiction, and as somebody who was formerly a student of nonfiction, who primarily writes kind of memoir-based pieces, primarily, I recognize that you have to transform your own experience. Sometimes it's suffering, sometimes you have to transform your own suffering in order for the reader to grasp it and connect it to their own life and their own experience. Think that the way you do that best is through image, or maybe that's the way that I connect with the idea, is through image and language. Werner Hayflick spent the evening at his catering job, making white wine spritzers and mixing vodka with tab in a spacious apartment overlooking Central Park. There were orchids, thick rugs, a dog with long blonde hair. He walked home late from the subway afterward, along the gated and padlocked streets of the Upper East Side. The trees on his block were scrawny and impervious, like invalid ants. Once he had seen a parakeet in one of those trees, staring down at him, shifting from foot to foot. The bird had sharpened both sides of its beak on the branch and then made a veering, panicky flight to a windowsill far above. Most of Werner's metaphorical moments were painterly, the juxtaposing of the wild bird and the tame tree, the shimmer of periwinkle, the splurt of titanium white that fell from it onto the pavement. He loved New York for its simple surprises, although in truth, Oregon and Iowa and Arizona and everywhere else had simple surprises as well. Cantaloupe-colored sunrises, banded cows, dairy queens, all kinds of things that didn't include black plastic mountains of trash and the smell of dog urine. But on that night, it wasn't like that. It was cold and fresh on the dark streets. He rounded the corner and his building came into view, a turn-of-the-century tenement where, right about then, just before midnight, December 19th, 1991, another kind of New York surprise was taking shape. Deep inside the walls, three floors below Werner's apartment, a sprig of cloth-wrapped wire sizzled and then opened like a blossom.
You say that primarily you're a writer of sort of memoir-based pieces, but there are notably certain works, I think of Sherry, which I will definitely come on to talk about, and Werner, where you very much think yourself into the mind of somebody else. When you are writing pieces like that, how much responsibility do you feel both to the, I suppose, to the facts as they pertain to each story, but also to the person that you are writing about?
Well, in those two instances, I felt a lot of obligation to the people I was writing about to adhere very close to the notes that I had taken during the research part of the writing of the piece. And with, you know, great awareness that in the case of Werner, he would be reading the piece and approving it or not approving it for publication, potential publication. And in the case of Sherry Tremble, that her family, that her daughter, Sarah, and her friends would be looking at it and thinking, is this who we recognize as Sherry at the end of her life? And for some reason, you know, well, not for some reason, for a good reason, I really wanted to please those people. First of all, I wanted access to those stories and I wanted to do justice to those stories, but I also wanted them to approve me putting those stories out in the world. And if they hadn't, I wouldn't.
Mm. And is that maybe, I mean, we talked earlier about, you know, sort of the lines between different genres or different types of writing not being helpful. But could that be, at least in these cases, what tips us into the realm of essay? Is that sense of responsibility, of not feeling perhaps the fiction writer's omnipotence to do what they want in the service of a good story?
Yeah, maybe I hadn't thought of it that way before, but yes, I think you're right. Yeah.
Mm. Before we look at some of the specific themes, some of the specific pieces, I'm just interested in this concept of the collected works. So, which is essentially the two collections, so Festival Days from 2021 and The Boys of My Youth from 1999. I was just intrigued, firstly, about the ordering of them, because it's anti-chronological. So the newer collection in the collected works is put first. Could you talk a little bit about what informed that decision and also just about whether collecting the works together, and I imagine going through them and proofreading and everything like that, did that give you a sort of a different sense of perhaps what your themes are or how you write or what you're doing than seeing them in two separate collections?
First of all, I have to say, I did not make the decision to begin with one book or the other book. And I tend to think in terms of chronological order. But I do believe that the publishers really did consider this issue. And they decided that the more recent work would be a better way to begin the book. And I actually don't know the rationale for that, but I can tell you that at that point in the process, I trusted them completely because, first of all, they came to me and wanted to publish not only my collected works, which was stunning for me, but they also wanted to pull out this long essay called Sherry and make it its own book, which I felt so incredibly touched by and moved by. So Sherry's story had haunted me for so long that it was really thrilling for me to see her get this profound appreciation, this beautiful little book that was published alongside the collected works. And both of them had these incredibly just delicate and powerful covers. So I guess what I'm saying is these two books published together and published so beautifully, they weren't just printed, they were published. They were the idea of putting these out in the world was really thought through by my British publishers. And also, I guess, you know, that they were coming out in England, in the UK, meant everything to me.
Well, let's stay with Sherry for a little bit, because it is one of the longer pieces in the books. And I think also it encapsulates so many different elements of your work and so many different themes which you seem to be circling in your career, that I think it could give us quite a nice jumping off point. I'd like to return to that idea of, you said the story had haunted you for so long. Could you talk a little bit about how you came across that story, how Sherry came into your life, and how you, and the moment you realized that you were going to then...
I had heard the story of Sherry from a friend of mine who was close friends with one of Sherry's daughters. And in the way that when you have a good friend that you talk to on the phone sometimes, far across the country, I used to sometimes say to my friend, "And how is your friend, Sarah?" And she would tell me, you know, Sarah's mother is very sick. And so I sort of kept up with that story from a distance. And then one day when I talked to my friend, she said Sarah's mother died finally. And I asked about it, just how did it happen and is Sarah okay? And she said, well, they took her to Michigan for Jack Kevorkian to help her die. Mm-hmm. And I was flabbergasted at the idea that this woman who I knew from a distance had taken her mother and been with her mother right up until the moment when they were ushered out of the house. And I just immediately connected it with the death of my own mother, mm-hmm. which happened in a hospice unit at a hospital, but still was maybe, you know, the pivotal event in my younger life. And I just wanted to go inside that story and see what it felt like to be Sarah with her mother. And so I contacted her from afar through my friend and asked her if I could research and write the story of her mother. And, you know, she was not certain for a long time, but then she finally said, yeah, okay, you can do that. And so I did. And I really did truly come to love Sherry through the writing of it.
Mm-hmm. A couple of things I want to pick up there. First of all, I know we have listeners of many different ages to this podcast. And I think certainly for me, I'm in my early 40s. The name Kevorkian immediately has resonance and meaning and was very, and the moment I came across it in the story was almost a... It shook me out of myself in a way. It was a very odd moment. But for our listeners who may be a little bit younger and haven't come across the figure of Dr. Kevorkian, could you just tell us a little bit about who he was and why this story, beyond your personal connections to it, appealed to you?
He was a doctor who worked in Michigan. He was from Michigan. And he's deceased now. And he believed in assisting people who were sick and dying and wanted to depart the planet before they died naturally. Mm-hmm. as the only way I know how to describe it. Maybe you can do that better than me, Adam, but he was considered by some to be a savior of the sick and dying because he prevented them from a certain measure of inevitable suffering. But he was thought by a lot of people to be, he was called Dr. Death. Mm-hmm. So the crucial thing about Kevorkian is that he was a real doctor. Mm-hmm. And he knew how to end life and end suffering in a way that was fast and painless. And many people reached out to him for his help. Mm-hmm. And he did it under the table, so to speak. So he did it out of, his own house in Michigan, frequently meeting his patients in a roadside motel where he would bring a contraption, a suicide machine, mm-hmm. that would deliver the fatal chemicals through an IV system.
It's fascinating, isn't it? Just as an aside, it feels, when I think back to when, Dr. Kevorkian was in the news, was in the zeitgeist almost to an extent, that feels like such a long time ago, and society feels like it's changed so much. And yet the discussion around assisted dying doesn't feel like it's, or it feels like it's only crept forward since then. And so reading about Sherry and the ending of her life feels, despite the fact it's sort of in one sense, because Kevorkian is there, places it in a certain historical time period, in another sense, it feels so utterly, but maybe eternally contemporary.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that probably he would not have agreed to help her, except that she, because she had terminal cancer. She wasn't mm-hmm. going to live that long, but she was unable to tolerate pain medication. And so her suffering was grievous. And he really listened to her in a way that perhaps the other doctors didn't. Mm-hmm. And he listened to her plead her case. He reached out to her after he got her letter and he said, I will help you because nobody else will. Mm. And he turned out to be, more sympathetic and kinder to her than any of the other doctors were. Mm-hmm.
At a moment in a different story, and in fact, in this case, not about a person, but about a dog, you write that we're in this together, the dying game. And when I read that phrase, my mind almost snagged on it, because reading sort of all of your work together, it did seem to me that obviously in Sherry, but also in Werner and in essays like The Tomb of Wrestling, there seems to be in your work a fascination with, let's say, the proximity to death, or the way one might engage with the potential or the possibility of death. Does that sound like a reflection that you might recognize?
It does. And I have to tell you, I didn't recognize that at all mm-hmm. until I actually looked at the collected works and I went, oh my God, people are right. Everybody who's been saying, that I circle that issue all the time. But in fact, I think that ever since I was a little girl, I've been aware, maybe since I was 4 or 5 years old, I've been aware that death is an enormous part of life. Mm-hmm. And, I spend a lot of time with and thinking about animals. And animals don't live as long as we do, obviously. Mm-hmm. And so I've experienced, a lot of my experiences with death have been with holding the paws of animals who have died before I was ready for them to go. I have to say there does seem to be a bit of an obsession with death, but come on, it's part of life,
Yeah. I mean, one of the biggest parts of life. Yeah. We might say. It's interesting you mention animals as well, because I would say death and dogs were your two principal obsessions based on the reading of the collected works. But I found that, I mean, I've never lived with a dog myself. I've lived with cats and shared my life with them and been through, as you just talk about, the sort of the passing of animals and that experience. But I did find your writing on dogs particularly quite unlike any other dogs I've come across in literature, in as much as it seemed the dogs didn't stand for anything. They weren't symbolic of anything. But neither were they sort of anthropomorphized or given kind of characters or sort of a knowledge beyond, what our relationship with them allows. They just felt like a very kind of honest, very empathetic, very sympathetic portrayal of dogs, in a way that I can't think of any other writer who writes about them so well, in fact.
Thank you. Thank you so much for saying that. And I have a dog right here who's listening to you, and I'm sure she feels good about it too.
She's a good girl.
She's a good girl. I do have to take this opportunity to say, I also love cats. Mm. I don't have a cat, because I'm allergic to cats, but I've had a lot of cats in my day, mm-hmm. Who just simply needed a home. So there you go. You know, even if you're allergic to them, if they need a home, then sometimes they come to live with you. And I do think that sometimes I anthropomorphize animals, but I don't care about that. Mm-hmm. I don't care about that. It's better for them if we do, if we mm-hmm. imagine that they feel the feelings we have. And that if the things that make us suffer make them suffer, then if we think about them in an anthropomorphized way, maybe we're kinder to them.
Mm. I think it certainly works better in that way than in the other way. Obviously, I'm sitting here in Paris, where Descartes is still held up as the sort of the founding of philosophy. And of course, his idea was that animals were sort of mere automata who had no feelings and no sense of sort of or no commonality with humans. And yet I think it's quite a mad thing, because anybody who has spent any time with a dog or a cat or any other animal knows how ridiculous that is, in fact, who knows that there are relationships to be had and an understanding to be had between human and animals, and to deny it seems, I don't know, dishonest in some way.
It's true. And there was a time, you know, for centuries, when people felt the same way about children. They mm-hmm. felt that children didn't have the same ability to feel as adults did. And children were treated very badly. So we are evolving, you know, we are figuring these things out. And someday people are going to look back at the way we have treated animals in our factory farms and in other ways, are beasts of burden, and they're going to be appalled.
Mm-hmm. Another element of your work, again, one of my sort of, when I was listing for my notes, the kind of the, what I consider recurring themes or things that you touched on or wrote about in ways that that I found quite striking, was, and I put this under quite the broad bracket, the idea of family. And it seemed to me that you write about family in a way that is, again, quite particular and quite unusual. And I was trying to ask myself if it was in some way also connected to class, because I found something I really recognized in the way you write about families, which is sort of to neither kind of idealize them nor catastrophize them, right. I guess the word would be, but to sort of present these kind of complex, slightly broken, but also fundamentally important units that we can kind of, I suppose, we can never escape from.
We can never escape. I have to say again that you are a really perceptive reader, because I wrote a novel in between the two books that are in the collected works. and it was called In Zanesville, and it was about my hometown. It was about my close friendship with, you know, somebody who's still all these many 50 plus years later, my best friend. Mm-hmm. And that book turned into a novel, basically, because I forced it to. But it's every bit a memoir also. And by the time I got done with it, I realized that this novel about my childhood was completely about class. Mm-hmm. And it was about class struggle. And it was about what it means to sort of jump class, to leave the people who raised you and taught you and loved you, and to move into another sort of realm. Mm-hmm. And then you never quite belong. You don't belong in the realm that you moved into because you feel deep loyalty to your roots. And you don't belong in the place you came from because you deliberately left it. Mm-hmm. And so it's interesting to me that you can sort of see that and feel it in the essays that were, I guess, really in the Boys of My Youth, mm-hmm. part of the collected works.
Yes.
So thank you for that perception.
Well, I think it's something I identify with. I think mm-hmm. it's probably the one of the reasons that I particularly sort of focused in on it. And indeed, in that perception of family is the sort of, I said in the broader sense, it's that idea of friendship as well. And it does seem, I think you alluded to it there, that sort of a few defining friendships do seem to provide, in a weird kind of way, almost sort of particularly to the Boys of My Youth, a kind of narrative thread in a way, the sort of the thing that keeps you, I don't want to say on the straight and narrow, but sort of certainly keeps you sort of in touch with, I guess, with where you come from, but also with yourself.
Yeah, I think so. And I have a couple of very sturdy relationships that began when I was, you know, in adolescence. Mm-hmm. And my friend Elizabeth, who appears, you know, in The Boys of My Youth and is essentially the character Felicia in my novel In mm-hmm. Zanesville, she's a constant. And she and I haven't lived in the same town since we were 17 years old. Mm-hmm. And we don't have that much in common anymore, except our past. And believe me, our past is enough to bind us like sisters. Mm-hmm. And that's like, she is one of the most important relationships I've ever had in my life and continues to be. Mm-hmm.
I can't remember who I heard say it, but it's something that has really stuck with me for quite a few years, is the idea that you can't make a new old friend. And I think there's definitely something, I felt that resonating through your work. It's like, however much you grow apart, or however much you change, or however much your centers of interest are no longer the same, they connect you to a part of yourself, which whoever you meet from now on, or whoever you've met in the last decade or two, is never going to be able to occupy that place.
That's exactly right. Mm. Never. So the idea of, you know, growing older and potentially losing some of these relationships is daunting. See how my mind immediately goes back to the idea of, oh my God, we're not going to be here. They're not going to be here. I'm not going to be here. Sorry.
I'd like to ask you about I can't find the exact quote in my notes, so I'm afraid I'm going to have to paraphrase you. But, well, first of all, a little bit of housekeeping. Are you happy with me to talk about you in relationship to the narrative voice?
Yes. Yes.
In that case, in which you talk about getting kind of tired or bored or frustrated with reading and realize that that's when you kind of have the understanding that what you want to do is right. And I'm just curious to know, is that sort of something in a sense which has persisted? Like, people will often say, I think, in a quite a reductive way, it's a sort of like, well, you know, you have to be constantly reading to be able to write at all. And I was just kind of curious whether, in fact, that might not be true for you, whether you perhaps as a writer need a certain distance from reading to find the headspace to work.
I think there is some truth to that. And way back when that was happening to me, when I was figuring out that I wanted to become a writer, I really, truly did leave books behind for a while, and I was bereft. I couldn't bear it. Books had been there for my whole life to keep me, number one, from being bored, and number two, they provided like intellectual stimulation for me that I was not getting anywhere else. I was working as a secretary. I was, you know, a party girl, bowling alley girl who would, you know, work all day at a typewriter and then go out and sit in a bar at night. And without books, which I consumed at an incredible rate, I would have had no intellectual life at all. I wouldn't have had anything to tell me that there was more in the world than what I was experiencing. And then when the time came that I just didn't really, I felt like writing them, not reading them. And it took a number of years to get back to being a consumer of books.
You mentioned earlier that you're also a teacher of writing. And indeed, in the collection, we have a couple of pieces where you reflect on the practice of teaching and also the process of writing a talk that you're going to give. I've done a little bit of creative writing teaching myself in the past and stopped because I didn't think I was particularly suited for it. And every so often I'll come across somebody writing about it that convinces me that I was correct. and so there's, I think of George Saunders's book, A Swim in the Pond in the Rain.
Yes.
And also your work here. And that you seem, I could only think that your students must be incredibly lucky to have you as a teacher, because you seem to not only to care about them and to care about their sort of development as writers and development as people, but also you don't seem to have been, let's say, captured by some of the terminology of what I think of as like the creative writing industrial complex. Would you talk for a little bit about what it means to you to teach and how that feeds back into your writing, if at all?
I think, of course, it does feed back into my writing, just like everything does. I can't quite tell you how, because a lot of times what it does is it interferes with my writing. Because teaching, as you know from having done it, is a creative endeavor. And so I pour a lot of my creative energy into their work and into trying to present my ideas about how to write. But that said, I actually love teaching, and I feel like I'm better at teaching than I am at writing, and that I was taught by people who were scholars more than they were writers. And I think that made a huge difference too, because they taught me how to really read and analyze the work of great essayists. And that's what I try to bring to my students is, you know, the ability to look at the work of the masters and figure out how they did that or why they did that, and then simply try to emulate it. And the other thing is that when you're teaching nonfiction, the personal essay or memoir, you're actually asking people to take their own life experience and go deep inside it, examine it, analyze it, and figure out the deeper hidden meaning, which, of course, what we know is that there is no deeper hidden meaning in life, day-to-day life. So you have to actually apply meaning to what happened to you. And you have to use it to illuminate something about that's universal about living in the world and being a human being. It's really, really hard, but it's really gratifying. And even if you don't get there, which most of us strive, but we don't get there, the act of doing it is worthwhile. The act of examining your own life, your own role in your life, and finding meaning in it is It matters. Mm. It matters. So I feel in that way, like my job really does matter.
Mm. And you also say that half of your efforts are spent trying to convince students that making art is in fact difficult and is supposed to be difficult. That feels in some sense very much kind of against the grain of how we are often brought up to think of art and artists, in fact, as sort of as art being something rooted in inspiration and or talent, perhaps, and this idea that it is something that has to be worked at and has to be suffered, and not suffered in a kind of, let's say, sort of romantic way, but suffered through the kind of the long hours of toil. It's quite an unusual perspective to see to see set down, and perhaps an unpopular one with your students.
Yes, well, you know, the interesting thing that they wouldn't want to know, but I know, after teaching maybe, you know, 1,000 people over the course of my career, is that the ones who succeed, who become really good writers that the world recognizes, are not frequently the ones who have the most talent for language, but they're the ones who are ambitious and have a talent for insight and effort. So that's a little daunting too, actually. That's really daunting.
And connected to the ambition, I guess, is it the ones you feel who put in the work as well?
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's what I mean by ambition. Mm. The people that you say, well, this isn't quite there. You need to think about it longer. Mm. You need to think about it, and maybe you need to live longer. And those are the people who will put it away in a drawer, and when they've lived longer, they'll pull it out of the drawer and they'll start working on it again.
Mm-hmm. I'd like to finish on a sentence I found fascinating, and I'd just like to unpack a little bit more. At a moment, you write, I'm tired of trying to describe things that aren't describable, which in a funny kind of way feels to me almost like a lot of the point of what you've been doing in many of these essays. And this is a sentence, I can't remember exactly where it comes from now, but I think it comes from quite near the end of the collection. After having worked so for so many years on your writing, and also, you know, I haven't necessarily been the most sort of prolific of writers. There's not sort of tomes and tomes and tomes of your work, which to me testifies to the fact that, you know, each essay is a kind of an effort and is kind of a struggle. Do you still have faith in writing, if you ever did, as a way of describing the undescribable?
I do. I have faith in writing that it helps you chip away at whatever the shell is and find the soft interior. Mm. And I think that's a deeply, deeply important part of life, not just of writing. And the essay that you're talking about where I say I'm tired of trying to describe things that aren't describable was really, it was a moment when that surprised me in the writing, because I thought, oh, I'm very nearly addressing the reader here, which I never do that I'm aware of. But it was a moment where I felt myself pop out of the essay and try to like say to the reader, this is really hard what I'm trying to do. I'm trying to write about my dear, dear friend who was dying in front of me of, you know, a terrible illness. And yeah, it was a naked moment, and it's interesting that it stood out for you. So thank you for that again.
Well, thank you. That is all we've got time for. It's been such a pleasure, Joanne. The collected works, as well as Cherie, are both available here at Shakespeare & Company in our bricks and mortar store, also from our website, or from your local independent store. I'm guessing in the UK? Are these are just editions in the UK, are they? The collected works
yes.
in Czechy?
Yes.
Okay. And of course, the books are available as separate collections in the US or wherever else you may be in the world. Joanne, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you for listening to the Shakespeare and Company podcast. If you've enjoyed this conversation, it would be great if you could help us spread the word by reviewing or rating us in your favourite app, or just by sending the link to your friends. And don't forget, if you'd like even more from Shakespeare and Company, you can subscribe now through Apple Podcasts or Patreon for just €3 a month. Links to both are available in the show notes to this episode. Production of this podcast is all done in-house here at Shakespeare and Company Paris. All music is by Alex Fryman, whose album, Play It Gentle, is available to buy or stream wherever you listen. We'll be back soon. Until then, take care, and thanks again for listening.